the gate.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucking Eastas? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. This is my my show. Happy New Year to you. Almost. Almost Happy New Year. Can we make it? Can we? For a second there, for some reason, I thought it already happened. But it's this weekend. We're going to make it. I think we're going to make it to another year. I think it's going to happen. I hope it. I don't see how it can be better, but I hope it can be better. I don't know what you've been doing, but it's been sort of interesting out here in L.A. We've had fires and weirdness. Weirdness in the skies. Just the other day, weirdness in the skies. I didn't get to see it. But I like, even though that NASA put out an explanation about it, that people still insist it's a UFO and that's a cover-up. The propensity and desire to engage in completely speculative, investigative theories, i.e. conspiracy theories, because they're so much more gratifying and interesting and have closure than the truth, which can sort of trickle out and sometimes is not as stimulating. So why not just believe the stuff with an edge that is full of bullshit? Why not just do that? That feels good. That's a package. Sure, that explains everything. That explains everything. It was a UFO. That explains it. Sure. The FBI is a completely corrupt organization. That explains it. Ugh. Oh, my God. So today on the show, I got a couple of friends of mine who wrote books. A couple of friends of mine who are, getting into the writing, guys I've known for a long time. My buddy Steve Danziger. Dr. Steve's been on the show many times. He's got his second book coming out. My buddy Mike Marcus. These guys are sober pals, sober friends of mine. I'll tell you a little more about them as I head into the intro. All right, heading into the New Year's weekend, be careful, please. Don't die, unless you want to. But even then, think it through. If you're sober, don't drink. All right, it's not worth it. If you're drunk, all right, be careful. If you want to drink, be careful. Thank God, man, the designated driver thing, that pressure's off with all these companies like Lyft, designated driver trip is over. You just got to call a service. Just call a service. Don't die this New Year's. And I'll talk to you a little bit on Monday on New Year's Day about it. We're going to do another show. New Year's Day, we're doing another thing. It's basically going to be New Year's Day with the Marons, which is... It's a collection of phone calls that I've had with my parents, my brother, mostly from the first couple years of WTF. We're looking back. But I wanted to share, before we get into the guest today, I want to share an email I got that I thought was kind of funny and a close call. And I'm grateful this guy's all right. Subject line, weird affirmation. Mark, I was en route to Spokane, Washington last Friday to pick up my daughter from college for Christmas break, listening to an episode of WTF. The road was snowy with one clear lane, and I was trying to get to the mountain pass before sundown when I hit some black ice at about 70 per. My 4Runner slid off the road, swam into a rock outcropping, and flipped end for end, landing 50 yards away on the roof. In the silence that followed the deafening crash, I hung upside down in my seatbelt, staring at the deflated airbags, wondering if I was dead. Then I could hear Marilyn Manson explaining why he shaved his eyebrows. I've never been so happy to hear something so ridiculous. I crawled out the passenger side window, not a scratch on me. Just wanted to let you know that your work reaches people in unexpected ways. I'm a big fan. Keep on keeping on, sir. That's from Ednor. Well, you're welcome, man. I'm glad it worked out. But that is a testament to, vehicle design. Holy shit. And good for you for wearing the seatbelt, and good for those airbags for popping out. And you're probably a little sore though, right? Probably a little sore now. I bet you are. Good story though. Good story. I'm glad you made it. I really am. Happy ending on that one, right? So listen, here's how this is going to go. My buddy, Dr. Steve, he's a therapist. He's also my sponsor, and also a good friend. And he's written this book. It's out now. He wrote it with Dr. Jamie Marich, called EMDR Therapy and Mindfulness for Trauma-Focused Care. We'll explain what that's all about in this talk. He is an EMDR therapist, among other things, and it's an interesting PTSD treatment, that and that PTSD can range from childhood, maybe emotional, to, you know, full-on combat trauma. It's very interesting focus in terms of psychology. So we're going to talk about that now. This is me and Dr. Steve. Dr. Steve.
Yes.
Aside from the book, which is specific, but not it's for everybody.
It's, you know what? It's really, this new book is geared more towards clinicians.
Yeah.
But people who are in EMDR therapy, or those who are interested in EMDR therapy and also especially interested in mindfulness, will find it clarifying in terms of what they're looking for.
Clarifying?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so you're saying EMDR practitioners. And what does that stand for again? Because we've gone over this, and you and I did a series of EMDR sessions, but I felt that it was somewhat effective in some areas that, you know, you just like kind of go in there and, you know, track down the bit, you track down the sort of the thing that's vibrating.
Yes.
Sending out, you know, panic. It's just like an SOS.
Yeah.
It's a SOS memory.
The amygdala is on fire.
Yeah, a little bit. Not complete wildfire, but there's just one little part.
Yeah.
Can't get it out.
A lot of my clients are of your description, which is like a long time sober and or a long time doing therapy.
Yeah.
And then there's these one or two or three or four stuck points that no therapy, no 12 step, no nothing seems to move. And then the EMDR therapy seems to move it.
But it's so easy to sort of want to classify it as some crackpot bullshit.
Yeah. Well, that's my first instinct when I was first introduced to it. It is seen as a evidence-based treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder by the World Health Organization. It has a definition as a psychotherapy, a complete psychotherapy, according to the World Health Organization.
So they're on board.
Everybody's on board. All the branches of the military, the VA, everybody says this is not crackpot, snake oil, goofballery. This is a psychotherapy.
We see results.
I see total results, and the research also shows results. So.
Well, here's my take on it. When we did it, is that you either use sounds or light to distract a part of the brain through repetition, so you can get right in there, and then you ask for, you kind of track down some trigger words, some trigger memories while you're doing this, while you're distracting the other part of the brain. What does it do?
So, first of all, the mechanism of action, of course, like all the rest of brain science, is largely theoretical, but there's a number of different theories as to what's happening. So that bilateral stimulation, the back and forth, some of it may be the integration of right brain and left brain.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing with the bilateral stimulation is that it produces this sort of mindfulness-based effect.
Bilateral stimulation through movement or light?
So eye movements or tones back and forth, or taps back and forth. Then there also is the orienting response, which is something found in nature amongst all us animals. And what's happening is that we're always scanning back and forth for danger. And so 98% of the time, there is no danger. The 1% of the time where there's someone that I'm attracted to, that's the go towards excitement. There's that. Then there's the 1% of the time where I'm a deer in the forest and it is a bear.
Yeah.
So I run.
Right.
Now, if I'm a deer in the forest, I run and I get away, and I'm not going to be talking to my dear friends about the bear incident because I can't. I'm not going to be on a shrink's couch 5 years later.
Uh-huh.
It's going to take about an hour for all the hormonal changes and all the cortisol and the adrenaline, all the rest, to kind of get out of my system. I might even violently shake at the end. But then when I'm done, I'm not looking up 102 times an hour instead of 100. I'm still in that same orienting response. So what happens with us people is that sometimes there's a, the wiring doesn't work quite right. And the smart part of our brain, you know, something terrible happens and we go, oh, that was awful. I'm never going to think about that again, which is impossible. It basically goes and stays in the amygdala or the basal ganglia or the body, somewhere where we can't have agency over it. And it could either be sort of completely below the level of consciousness, or we can get triggered easily by anything that resembles it.
So you say there's physical liabilities to to repressing trauma, and that repression either happens from survival necessity or conscious avoidance.
Yes, and
but it can have it can make you sick. It can make you have stomach problems, headache problems,
depression, anxiety, addiction. What happens is that, you know, the trauma response becomes coded in, and so our amygdala, our basal ganglia, our fight or flight part of our brain,
yeah,
keeps on responding anytime there's just an indication of something similar to what was before.
So in that way, it reactivates the vibration, the bad vibration.
Yeah, whatever the sensations, the physical sensations, the emotional content. And then what happens is that the reaction that we have to the current trauma then sort of cements or snowballs the past trauma, which snowballs the current. And now we're in a cycle and I need a drink, you know, for instance.
Or I need to kill myself.
Right.
Or I need to jerk off. Or I need to... hurt somebody.
All the ways that we might act out in order to avoid the feelings that come with that fight or flight response that is so uncomfortable.
Well, tell me about this cortisol. Just how much can I take?
Well, you probably have some of it coursing through your body like all the time.
I do.
I'm talking about you.
Me, I know.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you're just you're an anxious guy. And
what does it do? Does it get me off? Is it elevating? What does cortisol in and of itself do?
Well, it's part of the fight or flight response. It's part of that energizing that goes with the adrenaline to get you ready to take care of business.
So adrenaline and cortisol is the magic combo.
I mean, there's more neurochemical changes, but those are
the ass kickers. I'm going to kick some ass or I'm going to run fast.
That's right. That's right.
Those are my options.
Yeah, well, we got to have options.
Going to need that energy for either of those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then what happens is that the brain and the nervous system gets fooled and thinks everything is an emergency. That's diagnosable PTSD, but even below the threshold of PTSD, right? Instead of seeing a situation as like a difficulty that I can possibly solve using my cognitive and my limbic and my all of it, I just see it as this emergency.
Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's me.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it. You mean I gotta get it? Oh, the fucking tire. The fucking tire's flat.
Yeah.
But then there's also maybe not an emergency, but like, why the fuck does this happen to me?
All the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. But maybe twice it's happened in my life.
Exactly.
Why am I the guy, like I got a bad avocado this morning, and now the tire's flat.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fucking connected.
Yeah, the avocado and the tire and some other thing from when you were 6 years old that wasn't an avocado or a tire, but released the same sort of response.
My dad didn't show up for the thing.
Yeah.
When I had to be at the other thing.
Yeah.
So that's where it's wired in.
It's wired in. And then
whatever that is. And that's mundane, obviously, but nonetheless impactful.
Mundane, yes, to the outside observer, but in your experience, your gut, your soul, your psyche, that's where it, quote unquote, all started.
Okay, before we get into the nuances of EMDR, what about the approach of suck it up, you pussy?
Yeah,
You don't like the tough love thing? I know pussy's a dicey word now. Suck it up, you wuss.
Well, the suck it up part doesn't go with me either. So.
Man up.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, but
shut up.
But the 45 guy made a speech like that at veterans. You know that's all they need to do to heal their PTSD.
The 45 guy.
Yeah, the 45 guy.
The name we do not.
Yeah,
dare not say. Dare not say his name.
Dare not say his name. 45 asterisk.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, so no. That yelling at people doesn't work.
The problem is that people can't suck it up, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be better people, or there's any recovery there, or there's any sort of progress made or any treatment made. Mm. You know, sucking it up is a way that people live, and they may be relatively good people, but they're probably living in chronic trauma and chronic pain.
Well, that's the deal. So people who are chronically living in the survival response, as opposed to being able to... So when Francine Shapiro, who developed EMDR therapy, when she first started talking about it, and to this day, she talks about how the therapy is designed to help people live a more adaptive life.
Uh-huh.
Right. So what we do is we come up with these maladaptive, but they're adaptive at the time. Right. When I picked up a drink when I was 12 years old, it was a very adaptive move for me.
Yeah.
I needed that drink.
Sure.
But then eventually it became and it was kind of a maladaptive response at the time. But then it really became maladaptive. And then through my becoming sober and then also doing this kind of therapy.
Yeah.
I was able to let go of those maladaptive responses, and I was able to live, or I am able to live, a more adaptive life.
Yeah, but you're also a practicing Buddhist.
Yes.
You've done recovery work in several different programs.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the MDR. Like, you know, you're a guy, like, I've known you a long time, you know, it's not a matter of trying a lot of things. You're very diverse in the spectrum of your recovery, but spiritually, you know, you've chosen the path of Buddhism. Now, I had Thanksgiving dinner with a few Buddhists, and I got to say, my feeling was like, this feels a little weird. It feels a little stifled, a little muted, a little tamped down.
Where's the drama?
Yeah.
Yeah, where's the drama? So, first of all, there's a lot of flavor.
I'm not criticizing Buddhism, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was until I left. I'm like, oh, they're holding, they're balancing. What are they doing?
So there it is. So there's a difference between squashing it all down and being able to go namaste, y'all, and then, which is not for me like the way to go, right? That's just repressing stuff and then, you know, lying to the world by saying, you know, like, yeah, I'm totally cool with that. I'm balanced.
Very popular approach.
It's a very popular approach, and a little EMDR therapy with mindfulness infused can go a long way in working with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, so like the Buddhist approach, the core teaching of the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths. And the first truth is that there is suffering. But the translation of that is not just suffering, but also just unsatisfactoriness. So it's that continuum of, oh, it's not enough. Oh, I like that. I don't like that. Oh, God, I just don't really feel so great about life. Or I'm in the fear or the disdain for old age, sickness, and death, right? The big three.
Yeah.
So then the second truth says, and that's the diagnosis. So the second truth says the symptoms and causes of this suffering are not the pain of life, but rather our response and reaction to it. So it's the craving, the clinging, the attachment to outcomes and things and people and all that. So those first two truths are like, they're gnarly and they're messy. The third truth says you can actually end suffering. And then like any good psychologist, you know, or spiritual seeker or teacher,
right,
the answer is you got to go at the symptoms and more than that, the causes. So you need to end craving, clinging, attachment, and aversion.
Right.
So what you might be sensing, if those Buddhists are truly, you know, sort of, I'm not going to use the word enlightened, but if they're, you know, on the path, is that they have enacted that third truth, and they did that through the fourth truth, which is the prescription, which is the Eightfold Path, which leads to these four qualities: loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, like taking joy in your joy, and equanimity, which is that thing that you are sensing. Unless they were, of course, just repressing everything and they're just going to break out in a bad case of self-hate or hatred.
I don't know. You know, but it's hard for me to talk to people on the path sometimes because, you know, there's part of me that's sort of like, what's going on? No, seriously.
But, you know,
where are you at?
I get it. But my question is, but how do you experience talking to me? We talk a lot. We've been talking a lot for years.
I know what's going on with you, though.
So right. And am I legitimately equanimous?
I don't know. Do you really want to get into
that? No, we don't have to get into that.
Yes, you are. I do think you are. But I do see you apply it in the moment.
Right. Exactly.
You know, the thing is that there's a vigilance to it.
Mm. And so the deal is that the mindfulness meditation part, that's a way of getting into the experience in the body in order to settle the body and to also give the cognitive part of the brain a different way of relating to itself and to the body sensation, the rest of it. And over time, it changes the way it really does change the way a person kind of thinks things through and takes action.
I'm a big believer in all of it, and I do think that you're relatively spiritually fit, and you do the work. I find it to be impressive. I mean, I try to emulate how you would handle things when I detach appropriately, as opposed to just shut down.
Right.
Detaching and letting go. Now, but still, again, instead of like, man up, suck it up, you know, shut up. What about like, hey, how about like not reading so much into everything? Why don't you You know, give it a rest.
So that's the thing.
You're overthinking it.
Right, exactly. So that's the thing with EMDR therapy and other trauma-based and body-based therapies is that body-based, limbic-based, and cognitive-based, right? Because everything you're saying right now is talking to the cognitive part of the brain.
Yeah.
If all the information and all the feelings and everything there is below the level of consciousness kind of sitting there, then the cognitive part of the brain, actually blood flow slows down or, you know, during fight or flight, it can even stop in parts of the neocortex where it's kind of like... We have no use for your analysis here. We have to get away from the tiger or whatever's going on. Oh, absolutely.
Huh.
Yeah, it's kind of the analogy I like to use is when a person's in a coma, God forbid, right?
Right.
What a coma is all the parts of the system shutting down that are not necessary in order to maintain life, right? In order, you know, just I need to be breathing. I need to. So all the energy is put that way. So with this, it's like in fight or flight, I don't need to analyze what make of car is coming towards me. And so that shuts down literally to put all the energy towards.
You might want to try remember. So you,
when you
file a police report.
Exactly. But it could probably end up with you not having the opportunity to file a police report because you're too busy.
See, in just this conversation, if you had this with yourself at that moment, you're not good.
We're done.
All right, well, let's talk specifically. So tell me precisely what the EMDR does, and then let's talk about, you know how you've applied what we've talked about in this book to people like this. It's not just for... I mean, trauma-focused care, it's a specific title, EMDR therapy and mindfulness for trauma-focused care, but that could be fucking like a teacher.
Yes.
In a way. It's going to be important information for anybody who's dealing with particularly, potentially volatile situations or people who are dealing with people that are going to need guidance. So in that way, any sort of leader or any sort of person who's dealing with other people can be helped by the book.
Yes. If they look at the book, there's a huge, not a huge chunk of it. There's a chunk of it that's designed for step-by-step instructions for a licensed person who's been trained in the therapy to do.
Uh-huh.
But the rest of the book is absolutely, you know, pertinent. And I want to say that if someone is thinking of going into EMDR therapy, this is just my recommendation that the book is helpful in outlining what I believe and Jamie, my co-author, believes to be the best practices for achieving best results with EMDR. So you could go to your EMDR therapist and go, hey, do you do it this way? And, you know, give them a little guidance.
When we did it, we used what did I use? Did I have things?
You had the tappers, the little buzzers. Tappers. You were doing tactile.
And how does that go again?
So the therapy is an 8-phase therapy. The first phase is just getting the history, and we did that together where, and I do it with all my clients, where you're mindfully getting their history and not just like a general psyche.
But when you use the word mindful so much, what does that mean? Mindfully getting their history as opposed to what?
The way that we get the history is very specific. Mm-hmm. So an attunement and a mindfulness and not getting taken off the path will be very helpful to the therapist doing it.
Focus.
So the focus and that sort of non-judgmental awareness of what's going on and an ability to move with the client, let the client lead, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of mindfulness on the part of a therapist because, you know, we're trained. A lot of the training we get in school is like ask this many questions and get this information. All we want is some information about general sort of needs and goals around the trauma, and then getting those target memories.
But what if you don't know what the trauma is? Well, maybe some of this experiencing symptoms of PTSD or panic or anxiety or addiction. And you how do you go digging for the trauma if you're not going to spend hours?
Exactly. So that's the beauty. For me, that's the beauty of the therapy. It's a very structured kind of history taking that allows you to find those pertinent points, whether they be easily identifiable traumas, or whether they just be adverse life events that are stuck in that way, and then be able to have that as your material for moving forward, as opposed to getting into a long explanation within the context of the history and going over those details over and over and over again, which for many people is just re-traumatizing.
Yeah, because I think when we did it, I was able to isolate a couple of moments that have stuck with me in the way of sort of like, why did that happen? Why did I let that happen? Why didn't I make a different choice?
Mm-hmm.
You know, blame myself.
Yes.
You know, why did I find myself in that situation? Why was it perpetrated upon me?
Yes. And that's where why when we do the history taking, there's a lot of working with the negative beliefs about self currently related to those kind of memories, and to find those memories that are attached to that negative belief, because that's often the best pathway.
So as I'm talking to you, I'm doing the tactile thing, which is what I'm how does it work? Like if I was holding the tappers, what would you say?
Yeah, you have the tappers, and what happens is I will set up the target by asking you, what's the worst part of the image? You know, the image that represents the worst part of the memory.
Right.
Then the negative belief you have about yourself now as you think about that memory. Then the positive belief that you would like to have and how true that is in this moment, which is often very low, which is more activating.
Yeah.
Then the emotions, like what are you feeling? Sad, mad, glad right now?
Yeah.
As you consider this. And then the level of disturbance, 0 to 10. And then I ask for any body sensations that you're feeling. And it's at that point that I go, okay, so now I'm going to start the tappers and just notice whatever you notice as the tappers are going. And I turn on the tappers, and that's a silent part. So that's where it really, when I first got trained in it, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is actually a mindfulness practice.
I don't remember. You feel it?
Yeah. I turn them on.
Yeah.
And they're like pulsers. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So you get into that place.
And then when the tappers stop, you take a deep breath, and then I ask you, what are you noticing now? Right? Yeah. Mindfulness in this moment.
Right.
So, and it could be memories, body sensations. It could be whatever you're noticing now. And 9 times out of 10, after you say that, I say, all right, notice that. And we do the tappers again. And the material moves along. And what I'm listening for as a therapist is the material moving.
So as a therapist, as a practitioner, as somebody who works with in drug rehab, but in private practice,
yes.
So what's changed over the last year? What's happening? What do you see since the new regime? How has that impacted humans in your therapy practice?
So what I'm experiencing in my own experience, and then in the experience of the people who come to my office, is that there's a great number of people who are in the middle of a diagnosable PTSD that didn't exist for them over a year ago. The constant inundation with information that is threatening. If a person has already sort of like a trauma history background,
so they're volunteering for it because they're looking on their phone.
And at the same time, right, there's that a little bit of that, you know, maladaptive but adaptive behavior of, if I look on the phone, maybe this will all stop. You know, like that primitive part of the brain that's like, I better check, or I gotta keep myself safe.
Right.
Right. So volunteering, yes, but, you know, no differently than anyone who's addicted to heroin.
Right.
And as much as, you know, like that Buddhist formulation, craving, clinging, all the rest of it, you know, addiction is just, addicts do craving and clinging and aversion better than other people.
Yeah.
Like we're all engaged in that endless. So looking at the phone over and over again.
Right.
You know, eating food over and over again.
But you're seeing real symptoms of PTSD.
Oh, my God. All the time. What are those? I never lack for clients to begin with, but it's for the last year, people coming in who may not ordinarily have come in for services before.
What are those symptoms?
Hypervigilance, nightmares, daymares, re-experiencing either of previous traumas or anything that's happened over the last year. Like if something in particular really got to them because perhaps it impacted them as an individual or as a group member of a certain group. People are vulnerable to lots of other mental and emotional health and spiritual problems, right? Lack of meaning. That's a lot of what's been coming into my office. Like, how can I make meaning out of this insanity? You know, again, for
how do you sustain any sort of hope?
Yes.
And what is the point?
Mm-hmm.
And can what I do in my little life, is it even relevant to or important anymore? What's the point of doing it?
Yes. And that's why I find this particular type of therapy to be helpful, because it's acknowledging all of that and then taking steps to address each part of that. You know, the cognitive part, the emotional part, the spiritual part, you know, the meaning, the existential part, you know, all of it is Jamie likes to say, a tangled ball of yarn, or one of her clients said, it's a tangled ball of yarn, and what the therapy does is it untangles the yarn, and then you can address the pieces of it. And I find too, you know, my own EMDR recovery of my own, and then also training people all the time and working with people, and they do feel better.
Yeah.
And I actually get to see these results. You know, I see that people are able to find a way, and you said it, right? How can my little world, or how can my little contribution to the world have any impact on all that is going on? And in the end, it was never any different before anyway, right?
Right.
Even like 2,600 years ago when Buddha was teaching, you know, to people who didn't have phones,
yeah.
You know, he was like, your little life or your small contribution, you're interconnected with everybody and we're all impacting each other all the time. So why don't we try and take best care of ourselves? Let us be mindful. Let us be caring. Let us be loving, kind, and compassionate with each other, right? Mm. And so that's all the more important today.
Well, I hope we do all right.
Me too. I'm rooting for us.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good talking to you, man.
Yeah, always good to talk to you.
So that was Dr. Steve. The book is called Mindfulness for Trauma-Focused Care. You can get that where you get books. And as he said, it's a good primer to a lot of things, even if you're not in the practitioner racket. So now Mike Marcus is another buddy of mine. Mike's been through a lot of shit. He's tried a lot of things. He's been up and down. You know, we've been through some shit together. He's been there for me in some ways. We've had our moments of aggravation. We've had fights, and we've come around. We've come through it all. We've been through some shit. And, you know, he's a friend of mine, and he's written this book primarily about his old man. And God knows I'm sensitive to old man books. It's called Number One Son and Other Stories. By Michael Marcus. Michael Marcus. Yeah, Mike and I met in the rooms, as they say. And this is a good conversation. This is a good conversation. The book Number One Son and Other Stories is available now for pre-order. You can get it on Amazon. Comes out in January. This is me and my pal Mike Marcus. Mike Marcus. Michael Marcus.
What's up, buddy?
Author of a book now. You did it.
I can't believe I did it. No, you have no idea.
You've tried a lot of things, Mike. You've done it.
I think that would actually cover a whole podcast.
Well, we're on a podcast.
Shit jobs.
I can't remember, like, you were talking when you walked in that you remember, you know, when we met. I'm trying to remember when that was. Where was it?
It was in 2005 or 6.
Really?
Yeah, you were a cake baker for a meeting, I believe.
Oh, over at Hyperion.
Right.
Brunswick.
Right. Yes, Brunswick.
That's right, and you were this meaty, beefy fucking, like, you. I don't think you were roided out or anything. But
I wasn't roided, but I still had an image I was carrying from the past, you know?
Yeah, you were like some sort of badass or something.
I thought I was. You know, I go through these periods of like, and it's funny because the book outlines some of this, of like hanging out with R&B guys and hanging out with like Armenian gangsters and just different people that used to rub off on me.
But I mean, I have that quality too, that like, you know, you're not fully baked as a person.
Right.
Because of, you know, because of being emotionally shattered by fathers or mothers. So you kind of latch on to anybody with some sort of sense of identity, a strong identity.
Absolutely.
And obviously you and I are not going to gravitate towards the healthy examples.
Never. You know, you said something once when we were talking about daddy stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm looking for, are you my daddy? Every relationship.
Like a kid lost at a mall.
Yeah. Once you really see that, first of all, it's really gross and disgusting because it's like, wow, I've been looking for a daddy figure.
I think that we can change it over to father figure when, you know, the daddy figure, like I'm not looking for someone to take care of me.
Not a sugar daddy, but a guy that emotionally be like, hey, man,
I can guide
everything
you.
Okay?
Yeah, right. You're right. Okay, and I can show you the right thing to do.
Right.
You need to vice kid. You hang out with criminals.
You can't get that from a pimp.
But your father was a nutcase.
Horrible man. I'm sorry. Listen, my father was a horrible man. And I didn't really know that until he died. Because I was under the delusion.
You held it that long. You had him up on a pedestal for that long.
It wasn't a pedestal. It was just this really false sense of forgiveness and acceptance.
But also, I guess you probably identified with him somehow. I mean, yeah. You know, at some point, there's some part of you, the kid in you, always looks up to that guy, no matter how much you find out about his moral bankruptcy.
Absolutely. And there was so many different father figures. Like I said, I think I had a false sense of acceptance,
yeah,
and this forgiveness that came through doing a lot of work in therapy,
sure,
and a lot of work in whatever anonymous programs. But I think that a lot of that was bullshit. I think it was like that kind of fake it till you make it or act
thing. Oh, sure. You got it intellectually and you played it out.
Right. And it sounded good to other people.
Yeah, but it was disconnected from the emotional reality.
Absolutely.
But where'd you grow up?
I was born in Freeport, Long Island, and then we moved out here in the early 70s. First place was Thousand Oaks, then Fountain Valley. It's about 15 different places till I landed in Hollywood, went to Hollywood High School.
But what'd your dad do? He was like, because I remember—
He was a jeweler of Beverly— Well, he was an auctioneer in Palm Springs. That's where it started. And we lived in a little town called Banning, right near an Indian reservation,
yeah,
of all things. And my father met a man that worked at Caesar's Palace that started laundering money through his gallery. He's like, I'll bankroll the gallery, but we're going to launder some money from Caesar's Palace.
Your dad's gallery.
Yeah, it was an auction gal. He was like an auctioneer, but like a really smooth, not cattle.
Right.
It was like, okay, we have a Piaget polo here.
And right.
He had specific people he would point out in the audience.
So he's a high-end cat. He's playing
high-end cat.
That was the hustle.
Right. He had Jews that had made it through the concentration camp, yeah, with numbers on their arm. And, yeah, he'd say things like, this is a special diamond, Irv. Remember, it got our people out of the camps.
Oh, my God.
Like, do that kind of stuff. Yeah. And they put their fist up. And sure, 10,000.
Yeah.
You know, like, I learned very early on to be a split person. To be like that guy, very charming. And,
yeah,
you know, I was no problem with the women.
Yeah.
But this dark side of, like, stealing, lying, cheating.
Yeah.
Just real, real debauchery.
Yeah.
There was constantly this, and I usually got found out. It was usually months or years later, but I always got found out, whether it was in a relationship or with a step-parent or something like that.
But what are you growing up with this guy, like this guy with this hustle, like, and your parents stayed married?
My parents didn't stay married. My father went on to have, well, now he was on his sixth wife, but early on, yeah. No, my mother literally put us in her Impala at about 2 a.m.
How old were you?
I think it was about 5 or 6. 1969, I was, yeah, 5 years old. And literally ran away from my father with us in the car to her then therapist,
yeah,
Dr. Sigmund Lichter.
Yeah.
He lived in Huntington. He had the whole 70s, like, sex therapist look.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Van Dyke.
Uh-huh.
Goatees are cool, but a Van Dyke,
sure,
is that thing that,
sure,
really,
yeah,
you know, the turtleneck.
Yeah.
Occasionally a pipe.
Right.
And started with him. With this whole, like, the real California scene of the early 70s was like orgies, acid, backgammon, you know.
Backgammon's in there.
Steeler's wheel.
Yeah, stuck in the middle with you. Right, okay.
Literally and figuratively. And took us to nudist colonies. Now, that may sound really cool and hippie and all that,
yeah, so,
but
what, you're
at five.
Not good.
Right.
So at five, you're in this environment where, where's the house?
That house was in a town called Costa Mesa,
uh-huh,
which I'm sure we were the outcast. You know, Orange County, especially then, they, yeah, call, you know, behind the orange curtain,
right,
was refrigerator fucking white.
Yeah.
And to have these people strutting in, a Jewish therapist.
Yeah.
You know, my mother was like this party girl, like a lot like Shannon Stone's character in Casino.
Oh, Jesus.
Like that kind of a person.
Was she strung out?
She wasn't strung out, but she liked her Tanqueray, her Coke, and her Quaaludes. I'm,
right,
not going to lie.
Right. And you got a sister who's older.
Unfortunately, she OD'd and died.
Yeah.
She, now, see, here's the thing. If we can fake getting through our resentments or our anger,
yeah,
until it finally explodes.
Right.
I think we have a chance, whether it's therapy or working,
right,
through the 12,
right,
steps.
Right.
But she couldn't pull that off, Mark.
Your sister.
No matter how hard she worked in therapy, went to 12-step program, she could not let go of the rage she had against my father. And I think ultimately that's what killed her.
Because you need the relief.
Dude, ultimately resentments will kill me. I don't know about you, but like I see them clearly now.
You still have them?
I still have them, and I think...
I'm trying to think.
I stay spiritual by realizing I'm not the least bit fucking spiritual. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like on a daily basis.
Well, I think like my resentments, I try to, I negotiate with them. So I think I have them, but they're not as, you know, hot.
They're not as glaring.
Well, they're just not, you know, they're tempered.
Right.
Do you know, because...
But I've seen that in you over the last 10 years, because I saw you in your...
Fury.
Do you remember we were driving? I was looking for the New Balance store.
Yeah, I remember what happened.
You didn't even know where it was, but you were freaked out about the way I was going there.
Well, I remember because this was the first time we really hung out.
That's right.
And it was over in Pasadena somewhere.
Did I came and picked you up.
I guess so.
We were both so insane. I was like shitty and filled with grief and knew that I was the major problem in my relationship.
Right.
And she had every reason to completely fucking divorce and disown me.
The wife.
Yeah, the ex-wife, right, exactly.
Right, this is like, right, and then, you know.
And you were like, I was here.
Yeah.
Like curbside, and you were like here with this whole other thing going, and I try to latch on to that.
What was
it? Because I wanted to be angry at her too, you know what I mean?
Oh,
fuck her, blah, blah, blah. I'm like,
you were blaming yourself.
I was blaming myself, and I was like, shit, I wish I could borrow some of his rage. It's not working for my situation.
Oh, hating my ex? Oh, yeah, so we met in the middle? I didn't help you, huh?
I think it was 2006.
That's about right. Oh, yeah, that was horrible. That was right when she left, right?
You couldn't help any. I couldn't help anybody. Who were we going to help?
We're just going to get sneakers.
Right? That's all it was. What happened?
But, like, I remember when I first saw you, I remember there was a story you told. I can't remember if you were pitching at a meeting or you were actually doing a show.
Oh, because we used to see each other. You would go with Mishnah to do The Moth.
Right. But there, like, was it, but what was the story about the image I remember was you had to carry your jaw into the emergency room.
Oh, Jesus.
Like, you literally, like, you had to drive and your jaw was dislocated.
Broken in three places.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah, it was horrible. I was newly sober once again.
How many years ago was that?
This was 20 years ago, and I still have TMJ from a result of that. I still grind my teeth. I got to wear a night guard and everything. That's another story. I was in front of a tattoo shop, and I just got some work done, and I traded the tattoo artist the Stax Volt box set. You know how amazing that box set is.
Yeah.
Like... And I said, you know, that's the real shit. Motown's like cracker shit compared to this.
Yeah.
And that fell on the ears of an Aryan lowrider who had just gotten out of the shoe program in Pelican Bay.
Uh-huh.
The word cracker does not fly well from a guy coming from the penitentiary.
Yeah.
I had walked up to the subway. I was smoking a cigarette. And I see it for a second, a mid-sentence. You know, when your jaw's open, it only takes 5 pounds of pressure to break it.
Ugh.
They gave me the whole breakdown. And I got hit as I was talking, and I'm on the ground, and the guy looks down at me, and he's got like two of his lieutenants with him. Just scary motherfuckers, Mark.
Yeah.
Real Aryan. And I can handle myself.
Right.
But you get sucker punched, there's no way.
Yeah.
And I look up at him, and he's looking me in the eye, and he says, you got something to say about white people? I'm white. And I was just like baffled. I was confused. He helped me up, and he said, hey, you know, no big deal, right? And I was just like, yeah, holding my jaw going, this is really bad. I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And I got in the car, and I went to Midway Hospital. The next thing I did is I called a friend of mine who was in Pelican Bay.
Yeah.
Rest in peace, baby Ron. And I said, look, I think I want to shoot this guy. I have a 380 at home. I'm fucking out of my mind. I have a job that I need to speak at, talk to people. My jaw's going to be wired up for fucking, you know, it's horrible. And he goes, you know, don't do that. Don't go near that guy. He will take out your whole family. He will really make everything in your life disappear. And 6 months later, there was a whole article about him and this Aryan brotherhood that was pretty much running the penitentiaries along with the MA. Am I going to get killed?
Now?
Am I like giving information? I don't know. Anyways, that's what happened with the jaw. Of course, I lost my sobriety. I was making Soma and Vicodin smoothies.
Yeah. Soma, is that even around anymore?
I think it's gone.
Wow, there's like
didn't they use it in Brave New World? Soma was the drug.
That was the name of the drug.
But I'm just saying, it's funny that they're like, "Hey, maybe we'll use this name for this particular thing."
So you chose the higher road and didn't kill the guy.
No, I didn't kill the guy.
But I mean, that's 20 years ago. I don't think you're going to get in trouble for anything.
No, and I think he died of Hep C since then. So I think we're okay.
But that was the world you were in. That was what you know. That was what growing up the way you grew up reaped.
Right.
But what was this sort of ongoing dynamic? Because now you're living with the hippie doctor who's sweeping with your mother, and there's other people there, and there's nudists, and it's the 70s, and you're five. Now, what is your father doing? He's like, what's your father? He's like a,
At that time, my father was traveling, he did travel sales or something.
But from looking at you, your father was probably like a burly Russian Jew.
Romanian Jew, German Jew from the Bronx. State-raised lunatic, did 6 years at Elmira Reformatory.
State-raised? How the hell did that happen? What happened to his parents?
My father really liked nice things when he was a teenager and couldn't afford these things, so he would steal them.
Right.
And I think he stacked up quite a bit of burglary charges.
Oh, okay.
And they sent him away, and who the hell knows what happened there, but I do know that he became a Golden Gloves boxer while he was in the reformatory.
Oh, yeah?
So he probably fought his way out of
some
really
relationship. Did you know his parents, your grandparents?
I knew them when I was young. They were pretty nice people. I mean, they were angry and, you know, Romanian and German. Yeah. My grandmother was from Germany, and I believed basically got out just in time.
Oh, yeah.
She was like whatever, you know, whatever that upscale German Jew was about at that time. That's what she was about.
Yeah.
And my grandfather owned a couple of delis in Queens and in Rockaway. And there's a funny story about him in there, too.
Well, what?
He owned delis and he did tricky things with the meat to make the sandwiches look a little bigger. And
you stacked the middle.
He stacked the middle heavily. He used pickles that were left on the tables to make relish. Leftover seltzers were rebottled. Desserts were cut in a very specific way, both diagonally and horizontally.
Yeah.
My aunt told me the whole lowdown about this. This was just a couple of years ago. I reconnected with her.
Well, that just sounds like
is that normal? I guess
sure,
that just,
why not?
They do that at Langer's, I guess, right?
Well, I would hope not. I mean, there are health codes now. You're not supposed to take the pickles off the table. But pickles, like because of the vinegar and everything else, I mean, they're fairly... You know,
I guess that's all right, but not retooling seltzer, right?
Generally you shouldn't retool seltzer, but you know, that kind of seltzer is not really used anymore.
That's true.
But now it's mineral water. I worked at Gordon's Deli when I was in Boston, and I went down to fill the pickle bin up, and there was a bucket of pickles, and I scooped out a bunch of pickles. There was a fucking mouse in there. Dead pickled mouse. I told the owner, I said, Shelly, this bucket's no good. I found a mouse in there, but I don't think Shelly threw that bucket out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is a vinegar a disinfectant? I guess it's a disinfectant,
well, pickles,
so you're okay.
I guess it's a disinfectant. I don't know if it's, you know, I'm sure you're okay.
I'm sure you're okay. And I bet you that a pickled mouse is a delicacy somewhere.
Yeah, but that's.
Not here.
No rationalization.
I'm trying.
No, I know, but I'm just saying that, you know, dubious restauranteuring, dubious management of delis doesn't surprise
me. I guess it's not that big of a deal. Maybe Grandpa Sam wasn't so bad.
No, Grandpa Sam.
My dad had it out, though. There's no doubt about that. My dad was the oldest.
Yeah.
They constantly butt heads. And there's a deposition that tells a lot more. I don't really want to get into that right now, but there was a lot of stuff that helped me understand a little more of what my dad was about and the abuse that he had put up with. And he didn't have the luxury that we did, Mark. We have some luxuries therapeutically and 12-step wise.
Sure.
That me and you wouldn't be sitting here if we hadn't delved into. I think I could speak for you anyway.
Sure. But when did you start to sort of find that you were, you know, getting fucked up on your own, but also sort of honoring your father's legacy in a way?
That started pretty early. I started smoking pot. My sister was 3 years older, so she would turn me on to stuff. It was probably around 11 or 12 years old. I'd visit my dad for weekends.
Where was he living?
He was living in Newport Beach, Tustin, another town called Tustin. He had moved.
So you're real fucking Southern California kid, really.
Yeah, all over. And my mother had left. Well, actually, he died of a heart attack, Dr. Sigmund Lichter. He was working on his roof. He was roofing, which I thought was weird for a psychiatrist or for a Jew.
He died of a heart attack?
Yeah, very sad day.
What do you mean? Your father was a Jew boxer. You know, you're going
to... Well, that's true, but he went to prison. I think you're forced...
There's been plenty of, like, I used to think
don't
that
get
way
me
too.
Wrong. There's Jew laborers. There's, I was one.
Jewish cops. There's Jewish That's gangsters. True. There's Jewish plumbers.
Jewish gangsters, for some reason, never surprised me. Because growing up with my father and the people that he knew,
right,
they were all those guys. It was kind of like, you know, the killing of a Chinese bookie.
Yeah.
It was like when Seymour Cassell and his crew pulled up. I don't know the names, but it was like those kind of guys.
We're out here in the valley.
Mostly Beverly Hills. So it's those guys with Rolexes, maybe,
right?
I should
say, just rough Jews,
rough Jews. Yeah. And my dad had like Crips and Bloods working up there. They were like the bodyguards.
Where at the store?
At the Beverly, yes, 9460 Wilshire Boulevard, fifth floor.
That's where
right
he
above
ended
the
up
Union
the,
Bank.
This is so he closed the front in Palm Springs.
Then he moved to Santa Ana, had a little gallery there, actually a big auction gallery.
For jewelry primarily.
Jewelry, antiques, Keen paintings, Yamagatas, Tiffany Lamb. I mean, it just went on and
on. Where'd he get his shit? Was most of it real?
Well, a lot of it was real. You know, not the Renoir he sold for $400,000, but yeah, most of the stuff was real.
Yeah.
You know, staged diamond heists. It just a lot. It just goes on and on. There's a whole book just on that.
What do you mean staged diamond heists?
Well, like would have diamonds stolen while he was in New York and then have everybody take lie detector tests to see where they went. Like he would go through every possible stage of the insurance investigation in order to get the money for the diamonds and then would have sold them over here to somebody else.
Oh, wow.
That kind of shit.
Yeah.
Really deeply entrenched in all of it. You know, come through.
Criminal mind.
Nonstop. Nonstop. And it took a lot for me to break that.
The dynamic, you know, that happens, you know, where do you pick up steam? Where does the book start for you?
The book starts in 1991. One of the first stories I wrote was in 1991. And it was basically about the Air Force. I was in the Air Force guarding nuclear weapons, and I had a little crack relapse while I was there. And
well, when did you first get sober?
The first time I got sober was in 1981.
Yeah.
I was in an 18-month youth program.
For what?
They just made me a ward of the court. They were like, can you take him? We can't deal anymore.
Your back mother then, had enough?
My mother had enough. They made me what's called a ward of the court.
Right.
We were living at Oakwood Garden Apartments. My mother was now with another.
The furnished apartments with where all the actors live.
Different place then.
Yeah.
Heavy duty, different place. Not a place for a 15-year-old, let's put it that way.
Oh, really? What was going on over there?
Just a lot of orgies and quaaludes and a couple of shootings, like a real heavy R&B crowd, a real heavy like rock and roll crowd, punkers, some aging, you know, wannabes, whatever it was. And she was living now with this guy named Daniel Samuel Fagenbaum.
she gets the guys with the good names.
And he was like this guy that was a swinger up at the A-frame and had the briefcase filled with like amyl nitrate, quaaludes, handcuffs, dildos.
That guy? Your mom knows how to pick him, huh?
That guy.
Yeah.
And I had robbed him and I had robbed a bunch of places in the complex.
Did you steal his quaaludes?
I stole his quaaludes. I stole a bunch of money and drove to Mexico in my mom's car. I was just really like... the really cheap version of Less Than Zero.
Right.
Like if you moved it to Oakwood, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they just couldn't take anymore. I mean, drug dealers and addicts and alcoholics and junkies and the people that were hanging around there were all angry.
You, the kid. That kid's got to go.
Right.
Fucking the party up.
Exactly. So that was... So that was 18 months. It saved my life. I wasn't happy from 16 and a half to 18 being in this place that if I left, I was going to do 3 or 4 years in a really hardcore juvenile program.
Yeah.
And that would have been going right down the same road as my father, my real father.
Right. So you got out and you were clean?
I got out and I was clean. And
you joined the military?
I joined the military to get out of going to prison for a first degree burglary and a grand theft auto I picked up while I was coming over the border.
What was this after you got sober?
This was after I got out of the program.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of went ballistic and stole a bunch of more shit and took my mom's car and drove to Mexico. And I was actually going to end my life in Mexico. I was 18 years old, and I was just totally done. I was like, what am I going to do? I can't live like this anymore.
You stole shit to go sell in Mexico?
No, I stole shit. I stole, I think, about 10 grand in cash, maybe a quarter ounce of coke, and a bunch of pills that he had laying around. And I took my mom's car, which was really fucked. My mother was a visiting nurse, and she worked all over town, and all of her equipment and her files and everything were in there. And I shot down there, and I figured I'm going to drink and drug and do what I have to do, and then I'm going to drive off a cliff.
That was the plan.
It sounded glamorous.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that way.
What happened?
I drove back because I didn't have the balls to kill myself, of course.
And you ran out of money?
I didn't run out of money, oddly enough. I just knew I had to come back. Did you run out of blow? Did run out of blow. That was a problem. Okay, so you're right. There was a motivation. Couldn't get any down there.
Couldn't find any drugs in Mexico?
No. You're right? What the fuck?
So you drove back and got busted?
I drove back and got busted. They put me in San Diego Men's Correctional, and the judge called me up. It was there, I think, for the weekend. My parents wanted to totally press charges. And he said, well, what if we can get him to join the service? And it was weird. I know, it's a weird thing.
That's funny. It's like, you know, this guy's a problem, but maybe we can get him in the military.
But isn't that, I feel like that's the thing. You know what I mean?
Straighten him out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Straighten him out. And I went and saw the judge. And that's what he said to me. He's like, okay, you have an option. You can do 2 to 4 years in prison. We got you dead to rights. Good luck defending yourself.
Yeah.
Or you could join the military.
Yeah.
And like, I was a stupid kid. I didn't have a lot of awareness.
Right.
So I told him, can I think about it?
Yeah.
He was like, I'll give you plenty of time to think about it.
In jail.
Yeah. And I went back, and my cellmate was this really cool older black guy, seasoned criminal. This might have been the best father figure ever, Mark.
That you had?
Yeah.
Was that guy?
Yeah. He said to me, what the fuck is wrong with you? Go plead and get the fuck out of here. You're going down a dark road, kid. So I pleaded, and I ended up in the Air Force.
You're going down a dark road, kid.
You know what I mean? And I ended up joining the Air Force because that's the lightest of the four, basically.
Right.
It's the less training. But then I did this heavy duty training, and they made me a security policeman, and I was guarding nuclear weapons. Your face.
Yeah, then what happened? Oh, God.
You know, all went well for a while because I was up in a place that I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I was drinking, but talk about something that's so acceptable in the Air Force.
Sure.
I mean, pilots, everybody was drinking.
Yeah.
I'd see pilots shit-faced drunk were flying around in FB-111s with nuclear weapons uploaded.
Come on.
I'm not kidding you.
When was this? 80 what?
This was 84.
Yeah.
85.
Maybe they fixed that.
I hope so. They shut that base down, so at least we know that's happening.
That one's gone.
And I went up to Montreal and was on St. Catherine Street hanging out with, you know, strippers. And those were great times.
Yeah.
And I met this stripper who had the coke, and it was on. And it was like, first I was like,
You were just on vacation?
No, we go out like a little, they didn't call it Liberty, but that's what I'm calling it. We go up there and get the strong beer, you know, the good beer.
Yeah, we were
in Plattsburgh.
Oh, okay, New York.
It's about an hour and a half to Montreal. Right. You know the spot. And I just knew it was going to go wrong.
A stripper, Canada? You had a vibe? What could go wrong here?
But it's so deep down that it can go wrong. Because it's all saturated with the strippers and the whores and the euphoric recall. And this isn't going to be so bad this time. And it started from there. And I started snorting coke. And then I started smoking coke. And then I was...
In Canada?
No, I came back down. I would go up there and get the coke and bring it back down.
Yeah.
And they love service, man. I mean, you could have brought back anything from Canada.
Right.
You flash the military ID, you're good to go.
Yeah.
And there's what they called Operation Readiness Inspections, where you would be on post for about 18 hours guarding a bird with nuclear weapons uploaded.
Yeah.
And they would come around and ask you these questions. What's the ORI?
Yeah.
You know, oh, that's Operation Readiness. What's the two-man policy? Well, that means one man can't be around the nuke at one time.
Yeah.
What's a covered wagon? Well, that means the nuke's been stolen and everything's going to shit. Like, whatever it was, they would fire off these questions. And on one particular time, I just remember being so fucking coked out, Mark. I had just taken a big blast off the pipe. Here comes this general, a 4-star fucking general with like these two lieutenants.
Yeah.
And I jacked a round into my weapon because I was so freaked out. I'm like, if I fail this test, I think I'm just going to take him out and take myself out. Just crazy, been up for days smoking coke, drinking 151 thinking.
Sure, that thing. Yeah. Just that. You know, everyone knows what that is.
Yeah, no big deal. It's sad when you have to go all the way to 151. Like, I need the strongest and about 10 shots of it.
Oh, God.
And I was able to answer the questions and made it through. And then somebody wrote a statement on me and I got busted. A pilot actually wrote a statement on me for selling him coke because he, I guess it came up in his urine.
Oh, and you took the hit? Did he get the hit too?
He disappeared. I don't know where he went. Uh-huh. I think he went to another base and probably is no longer flying planes.
They just move him around like priests. Yeah. Everyone knows this guy's a blow monkey here.
Right.
Send him to New Orleans.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, Desert Storm? He's perfect.
Yeah.
Send him right. So yeah, that's, you know, I just never could be anywhere.
So was that a court martial or are you just out?
No, I actually had an independent lawyer because they have what's called the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Yeah.
And if you get stuck in that, you're being railroaded right into Leavenworth.
Uh-huh.
So I had a guy work for me and I got what was called a general under honorable conditions. Well,
you know, what's funny is the way you talk about certain things. It's like, you know, you know things that only a criminal would know. So in that way, you're definitely your father's son.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, don't go with the military lawyer. You're gonna smoke crack after 3 days awake and get nailed. You got to get an outside lawyer.
I love it. That's a great observation. I don't see that stuff, but I used to look at everything through a criminal or a sex filter, one or the other. Right? It was because that was the two things I was fixing on.
Yeah.
Obviously getting loaded within those two things, but those are the things that I fix on in sobriety if I'm not careful too. Like, what else is there? Of course, but food, but.
Right, well, you and I share that one, you know, and
you're better at it than I am.
But the whole getting loaded, the thing is like, what, you know, where did you, how many, like, what do you want now? What do you got, about 6 years now?
Yeah, 6 years, just over Again. 6 years, 6.5 years. I never had 6 years.
Really?
I never had that much time, no. I had 3 years, 4 years.
Huh.
Resentment, shame, or guilt are usually the things that take me out. And guilt can come in the form of not pulling off something that I thought I should have been able to pull off to be at a better place than I'm at midlife, if that makes any sense.
Well, I mean, what seemed like the last time, but you were always like, you know, high roller, right? I mean, it's like.
It's been years. When I met you.
But like, what was going on? Like, I remember there were just, you tell me these stories about. Like, just like, you know, all this cash and art and you had a nice house.
Yeah.
What were you doing then?
Well, those were all proceeds from dealing drugs. After Daniel Samuel Feigenbaum, I was grandfathered in to a very exciting career in dealing pills. This was in 2000. He shot himself in 2000, actually.
He shot himself in 2000, Daniel Samuel Feigenbaum.
Horrible situation. He had bladder cancer, and he was a manic depressive. They had to take him off the lithium because it's a salt, and it's very hard on your bladder. So they take him off for a while. They refashioned or did some new operation where they basically built a bladder for him out of his colon, and he came back.
Oh, my God.
I was intense.
So this is after you hit the wall with the military?
This was years later. This was probably 15 years after.
But I mean, so you get out of Leavenworth. You don't go to Leavenworth. You get out of the military. You're not court-martialed. Do you clean up again?
I clean up again. I moved to New York City, which was actually a really good time.
Yeah.
In New York. I was actually living on Long Island.
Late 80s?
Yeah. 86, yeah. 87. Great time for like hip-hop.
Yeah. And
pretty much the end of the punk rock era. Great new wave situation. You know, Jean Bosque, Jean-Michel. Like, it was a really cool time in New York.
And you were met going to the city?
I was going into the city a lot. I was hanging out with some pretty cool guys that I had met there. We were going to a lot of clubs. I was sober, but still a maniac. Getting into fist fights. You know, I beat down a cab driver. Like, just still a maniac because I never really dealt with that stuff in sobriety. So abstinence for us can be just as deadly, right?
Right. So when did you relapse? How did New York end?
I I moved back to LA in 1990.
Yeah.
And my stepfather was really dealing heavily. Him and two Jewish counterparts.
Which one was this? Which stepfather?
This was Daniel. Dr. Dildo was his name back in the day. But now he was like Dr. Dan. Just Dr. Dan. Okay. He had mellowed out from the A-frame.
Right. What is the A-frame?
The A-frame is still there. It's a house that's at the very top of Mulholland. It was famous for its 70s swing parties.
Oh, okay.
You know, like the keys and the bowl situation.
Sure.
And I came back here and I relapsed again. And I started taking money from him. And I ended up in another rehab.
What was the drug usually?
I was smoking coke again.
That was your thing?
Yeah, that. And he had a bunch of pills. I was taking Xanax and Valium.
You're a freebaser. Basehead.
Oh. God, yeah. Well, when you say it like that, yeah, because that's the old school, you know,
right.
Richard Pryor.
Before crack.
Before crack.
So you had to base your own shit.
I had to base my own shit. It was clean. I used 151. Uh-huh. It burned really nice. Like ether. Ether was the real shit.
Yeah.
You know, it's so sick when you're really so into a drug. Like when I heard about Richard Pryor freebasing, like I wanted to know really how to do that. Was my hero, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to really know how to do this and get into
it. What's the chemistry?
Yeah.
Do I need what equipment do I need?
Right.
And you figured it out.
I figured it out.
Yeah.
And it was
you broke that shit down.
I had a love-hate relationship with smoking coke for about 29 years.
Because there's the sort of ghetto way to freebase, which is just with, you know, baking soda and then you kind of swirl it and swirl it.
Well, that's not ghetto.
No.
That's another form of freebasing, even though they went from ether to baking soda, but the ammonia is the real getaway. That's like the really addictive crack shit that hit the streets.
Uh-huh.
And I found myself down there a lot when I couldn't get the coke I wanted. And then that whole thing started going downtown.
All right. But we're not there yet. So now you got Dr. Dildo's, like, you know, he's dealing. This is before he gets the bladder cancer.
Right.
You're smoking coke. You smoking it with him?
No. He was totally clean and sober. Oh.
But so what happened? So you're stealing from him to
stealing from him. They find out I'm stealing. He kept a safe under the stairs with like $180,000 in it. And I started, you know, by the way, if nobody believes this, feel free to ask my mother. You know her.
In Mexico.
that's something else.
Yeah.
She's not hiding out, I promise. Yeah. And I started taking money. And one day when they had to come up with some money for a situation that occurred, they looked into the safe under the stairs. And there was a lot of money missing.
Yeah.
And I'd been living off that money. And then he wouldn't talk to me for years. I went back and made amends to him years later. And in between that, I worked in a film laboratory. I worked at Color by Deluxe. I worked at Technicolor.
Oh, you weren't selling drugs?
I was selling a little pot.
Oh. So after New York, you know, you
came here.
Yeah, took the money.
Took the money.
Got fucked
just
up.
Just a lot
coke.
Of scandalous shit. I was doing like credit card scams and whatever, workman's comp. Well, you know, what do you got? Let's see how we can
What's
work this.
What's a credit card scam?
Credit card scam. I had a crew of guys that would break into those big mailboxes at like apartments and stuff, crack those open.
You're that guy?
And just strip through everything and find the cards and just send a crew of about 10 guys out and go on a shopping spree and usually bring the stuff back. Yeah, fence it. Or Nordstrom's was really good. They would always take stuff back and give you cash usually. So. Uh-huh.
And this was primarily for money or for drug money?
It was for money and drug money, but I hate to admit this, but I did stuff like that sober too, just because I didn't want to work. And I had this idea that, like, why not? You know, I had
fucking
very
criminal.
Criminal. And I'm sitting in your garage talking to you about it.
Fucking criminal.
And not in jail.
I know.
You know?
So wait, so when did, okay, so. So that's so, but you did have a job.
I had a job, and I've had jobs over time. But like the film industry job ended very quickly when Danny got cancer because he brought me in as like a partner to help him sell his pills. He had a bunch of people up and down the coast.
So he was a drug dealer.
Oh yeah, big time.
Dr. Dan.
Yeah, he had doctors. He had been working probably for 10 or 15 years
for the scripts.
Yeah.
So now he needs a partner because he's sick.
He needs a partner because he's sick.
Because he needs to bring the kid in.
Bring the kid in. He robbed me, did whatever, but we don't have any choice.
Yeah,
he's can't a go criminal. Outside the family.
He's a criminal.
He knows.
Yeah. He's who else are you going to trust?
Not his kids, believe me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I started like doing the whole situation, going to pharmacies. Then, of course, I got strung out. And I started stealing prescriptions from doctors and writing my own.
Pads. You stole the pads?
I stole the pads, and I stole triplicates, which are the ones they use for like cancer medications, Dilaudid, stuff
and
like that.
And you figured out how to write the scripts?
Well, my mother was a nurse, so it was usually, I knew how to write what they call the Greek.
Yeah.
You know, the Greek is the prescription
yeah.
wording. And I got back on that train again, man, and
what
it was
were you
a
taking?
Nightmare.
What were you doing?
It was probably, it was so many different things, but my I like to snort Dilaudid. That was my favorite, yeah. That, yeah, that, a little Percodan, a little Soma, Xanax.
It crunch it Dilaudid up.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, take the edge off with some crack, because I tried to find that place. You know, Mark,
sure,
that
the crack
place?
Dilaudid place?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you just good?
I was good for a while. I took the drug proceeds. I invested in the market. I did pretty well.
But you were running up and down the coast selling, you know, delivering
not up and down
shit.
The coast. There was a guy in Santa Barbara. There was a guy in Orange County. So yeah, basically. And
Were they dealing or they were just buying?
They were just buyers, big buyers, yeah. big buyers. I would go up to Santa Barbara and this guy would buy $6,000 worth of drugs every month, like clockwork. And then I was like, hey, do you think you could put me on the books as a salesman? I'm having a problem, you know,
what?
Washing the money.
Yeah.
So he did that. And of course, he expected a better deal. And we worked something
out. Oh, for his
out.
Company? You were a salesman? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had him. God, I had a bunch of people. I had a mattress salesman. I don't want to talk about his name, but it was a bunch of different people. Guy had their own Galpin Ford. Not his name wasn't Galpin. But I had got these really crazy accounts. I was probably after all my expenses, I was probably doing 20, 25 grand a month.
And this is in the 80s?
This is actually in the mid to late 90s into the early 2000s, yeah.
So when does Dan get sick? When do you hit the wall? So what you're saying to me is you're making a lot of money. This is the golden age here, right?
Yes.
This is where you buy the
my ex-wife used to call it the house that Percodan built.
So this is when you buy the house. This is when you're going to go legit.
Yeah, I'm going to go legit. I'm going to really do the right thing. I got this great
life. You got all this drug money?
Great drug money. I got some friends on Wall Street. I'm learning how to invest. It's the tech boom. There's great stocks.
You making money?
I'm making money. I'm trading stocks. I'm making money. I have a shitload of cash and some drugs I put in a box.
Yeah.
In San Fernando Valley, in these boxes, was called American Data Vault. You could get a personal box under an assumed name and stash a bunch of stuff in
so
there.
That was your emergency package?
That was my getaway.
Is
yeah.
It still there?
I had a fake identity in there.
You did?
Yeah. Robert Haskup was the guy.
You had a passport?
No. I didn't have a passport.
Uh-huh.
Because I couldn't have left the country with all that money anyway.
So you had a bunch of money, a bunch of drugs, and some identification.
Yeah.
For another guy.
For another guy.
In case.
Just in case.
Is it still out there?
No. Actually, the Patriot Act closed those places down. American Data Vault was shut down. There was three of them. There was one under the World Trade Center. There was one here, and I think there was one in Orange County. But after the Patriot Act, you were not allowed to have those anonymous boxes. It was such a sad day.
Do you have guns in there?
I had a 44 Magnum. I had a Sig Sauer 380. I never used guns, but I just to be on the safe side.
In the box.
A couple
of guns
around.
Box.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you grew up with guns.
Yeah. Well, yeah, my dad had them. But,
right. And they were legal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, all right. So you bought the house. You got your escape plan. You got money. You're buying art. You had a nice Craftsman.
Yeah, right up here on Wildwood.
Yeah, yeah. And when, oh, really? Right up there?
Right on Wildwood. That vaulted, the rounded. I don't know if you've seen that one at the very top.
Up here.
It's like a Neutra case study home.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, great wife. Everything was going good.
No kids.
No kid.
You're sober? This is around when I met you or no? Before? No,
no
just
this
before.
Is before. Just before.
Yeah.
Just before it all went south.
So
and
what happened?
She came home and caught me smoking crack in the bathroom. I was trapped in the bathroom. She said, if this happens again, we're done. She came home a couple of months later. Same thing happened. And I was
she's
like,
sober.
She's not sober, but she was not like me at all.
Yeah.
If anything, probably had some Al-Anon stuff going
right.
on. And came home again and said, you need to go to detox. So I went into Cry Help to a detox. I left there after a couple of days. I didn't like the way the detox was going.
Uh-huh.
That's a story in there. It's called Enterprise Will Pick You Up.
Uh-huh.
They picked me up from the detox and rented me and a guy that I met in there a car.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They'll pick you up wherever you are. It's great. It was a pleasant experience, really.
Yeah.
And ended up going to a yet another rehab, this place Promises, out in West LA. And, you know, we tried to work it out, but she was so done. You know when people are done and you're just...
Oh, do I know when people are done? Yeah, I do. I know the exact look of when people are done. I know the moment it happens.
It's... Yeah, you're good. I think you're better at that
and
than
if you,
I am.
And if you
you're
really,
less delusional in that world.
And if you really think
am.
About it, well, it only has to happen a couple of times.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And you know, and the thing is that when you see that look, there's nothing you can do.
No.
You've burnt no more resources.
No.
More bullshit.
You're right.
No dance is going to change
it. No amount of money, that's for sure.
Oh yeah,
no promises. Yeah.
Oh no, that's true. Yeah. So all right. So what happened?
Thank you for taking me down this timeline because it's so jumbled in my goddamn head sometimes. So I went there. I went to the sober living of Promises, and that's when I got the call from American Data Vault that, look, you got to come and get everything out of your vault. We're shutting down, and I couldn't go home, so I had probably about $700,000 in there.
Get the fuck out of here.
Why would I lie to you?
Right.
I didn't have any drugs in there. I had the phony ID, but I was like, all right, I'm not going to have to go anywhere. I'm going to figure out a way to do this. Can the IRS come after me?
I don't know.
Anyways, I don't give a shit. I bring the money back to the sober living. My roommate, nobody knows about it.
What's in a duffel bag?
Yeah. It's in a, like one of those big, like college bags that you would wear, put your computer. It's a big bag. It's a big backpack.
Yeah.
And I have a roommate who's working for a major production company, and I ask him if he can put me on the books as an associate producer, and I give him like $6,000 to $8,000 a week, and he writes me checks, and I slowly start legitimizing some of this money once again.
Yeah.
And I just continue to do things like that, and my wife leaves me, and I go on yet another crack run, and it's really bad. It's really bad. It's another really bad one. Thank God it only lasted a couple of months.
Where'd the money go?
Still had a lot of money. Still had a lot of money in stock. Still had a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And I bought that house
that
I was living in.
The Wildwood
which
house?
Was a big mistake.
The Wildwood house?
No, Edgecliff, right in the center of Silver Lake.
Oh,
that was in 2005. And I
right
knew
it
was a
of
big
it?
Mistake.
Right in the middle of the peak of the fucking market?
Well, here's what my delusional mind told me. If I buy this house and set it up really nicely... Me and my wife will be back together and we'll have a rental.
Oh, yeah. So,
you know?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I lost everything because I didn't have that hustle anymore.
Right.
Obviously, I couldn't sell pills.
Right.
That was done.
Yeah.
I couldn't really trade stocks because the pills had given me that panache to do that.
Yeah.
And everything just started swirling the drain, man. And it was a long... It started in about 2008 and it ended in 2010 when I had to short sell the house. And I went through like years of poverty living.
I know.
And shitty jobs and getting excited about a script that I got paid for. And
I know.
Which was a great experience now that I look at it. You know, this is an amazing thing to be here. And I was thinking of stuff that even comes close to this.
Yeah.
And it was doing an improv jam with Robin Williams.
Oh.
Two nights in a row, dude.
Oh, at UCB?
Yeah.
When he was relapsing.
He was just a big sweaty mess. But like, what an experience.
Because you were doing a lot of storytelling stuff.
A lot of storytelling and improv really helped my storytelling.
Right.
It really helped put things in perspective. It put a positive twist on a lot of areas of my life because I was just so dark and negative all the time.
Yeah. But you were trying to like, you know, once you got through the poverty and once you got, you know, sort of got back on your feet, you were coming up with a lot of stuff, some pitches. You had the diamond store pitch.
Yeah, that's kind of out there circulating. The Marcus and Company, that's the story about my dad. And that's, we'll see, who knows. But I have that. I have the other one I was telling you about. I don't want to mention on here, but that one.
Oh,
Yeah.
Is it still out there?
Actually, just got some really good notes from
UTA. Really?
Yeah,
good, so it's pretty exciting.
It's pretty exciting. And then there's this other movie I'm working on now about my adventures of being a sober companion. We're actually shooting it.
Oh, the sober companion stuff. That's crazy.
Oh, it's so good. You're going to love this thing. You're going to, like, this is
but
the kind of movie
that's a
right
real
here.
Job you do. I think, that's something, like, I mean, that's a job. Like, you know, you get hired by people with money to basically stop them from putting things into their fucking mouths or their arms or whatever.
Right. What you're really stopping them from doing is killing themselves because they're all going to get loaded. They always get loaded. I mean, the weird thing is the message I got from this guy's dad was keep him alive out of New York. I can't tell you.
Oh, yeah, right.
But like,
this is a client.
Yeah. Yeah, client. And I went back to New York with him, and it was just, it was overwhelming. Like, I've known people, we all know people with money, but this is like 1% or shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Where like they're hosting Hillary
Clinton
parties. And
you were hired by his father to.
I was hired through a company by the father to do that, yeah.
So, but it's an interesting job because it's not so much about like, you know, the program. It's really about like, you know, like this guy's, he's on a death spiral.
Yeah.
And you, I mean, you want them to be going to meetings. You're supposed to take them to meetings. You're supposed to do whatever. But but it's not necessarily like this is not program condoned employment.
No, it has nothing to do with a 12-step program whatsoever. And when you are working with a guy who's, you know, in his mid-40s and really all he wants to do is impress his parents to get the trust fund, the Lamborghini, Range Rover back. It's frightening. And there is, I think there is a disease of affluence. Some people call it white privilege, whatever it may be, that really drives that when somebody like this guy was brought up in this ridiculous amount of money, Mark. Like,
So you work on a film pitch about being a sober companion?
I found a group of millennials. These guys are amazing. They helped me do so much creative stuff. And we've already started shooting stuff. We've got a proof of concept and a trailer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah, I'll send it when you have time. I know you're not busy now, but yeah, I got a great group of guys.
And you got a good girlfriend now, wife?
A wife.
You're married. It's nice.
She's so amazing. I really, if there is a God, she's a God.
Well, I was very surprised at how you, like, you know, watching you arc through those lean times and even lending you money in the back of my head thinking, like, what the fuck did I just, I'm never going to see. And you were very, very sober about getting it back to me.
Of course.
And it was, you know.
There were some issues there, but I learned an important lesson. Your friendship's way more important to me. Like, I would rather be not having money and maybe living in the car than ever borrow money from a close friend again. I don't want to go through that.
Well, the funny thing was is that when I did it, you know, people always tell you, it's like, no, you don't expect to
say
get
goodbye to that.
But not just you, anybody.
Right, of course.
You know, and I don't know why I never thought that way, but they basically, people say, if someone needs money that badly, you're not going to get back.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I've dealt with that with family members and stuff.
Right.
And like, I didn't want to accept it with you for some reason. And for some reason, whether it was belligerence, because, you know, it did kind of cause a ripple in our friendship, but you're like, fuck him, I'm going to pay him back.
Right. Was I like that?
No, but I'm wondering if
it wasn't like that. I think there was actually more guilt about ever asking you and getting it in the first place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I learned early on not to loan people money. Well, that's the thing. You grow up with a criminal, you learn not to loan. And if you do, you have a guy that, you know, goes and collects it and deals with it the right way.
Well, like, when did your father die?
He just passed last year, actually. I got to send you the picture of the headstone. It's unbelievable.
What does it say again?
You know, it's a line out of Frank Sinatra, you know, the song My Way.
Right.
And there's an auctioneer's gavel and a Rolex on the top of it, which is so perfect.
And that's his wife. His last wife did that?
Yeah, yeah. Who's, you know,
what was the line?
And through it all, through the tears, through the laughter, I did it my way. I'm like, okay, there was a lot of laughter. I don't remember the tears, but okay.
But what did you, like, in writing the book, which is called Number One Son and Other Stories by Michael Marcus, you can get it on Amazon, huh?
Yeah, I'll get it through Punk Hostage Press.
Punk Hostage Press.
And there's a link to Amazon, yeah.
But like, in having the issues we have, like, I've met your mother. She's come to see me work, you know, and I know that, you know, your sister's death brought you two together in a deeper way.
Absolutely.
And she's got a lot of sober years, your mom. And she's a great lady. I met her. But, you know, when you have an unrepentant father who degenerated, like, where did you leave it when he was conscious? What happened to that relationship? Was there any?
There was a little closure, if that's what you're
asking.
When
he died? But, like, what was your relationship before he died?
I'll tell you. He was in a convalescent home for dementia and Alzheimer's patients. And about 3 years into that, God, he was there for a long time. I think he was there 6 or 7 years. I went to visit him and I hung out in the room with him. There was like 2 beds and he had his own room.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of on the computer. I had jet lag. It was in Atlanta. And he woke up in the middle of the night and he said, Michael. And I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. I just want to apologize for everything I did to you and your sister. I kicked you to the curb through your drug problems. I took your mother's checks and never gave her child support. I'm like, yeah. Well, I'm sorry. And he went back to sleep. And I was like, if this
is, that it?
Is as good as it gets, I guess it's a little better. And that carried me. It fucking carried me. And then when he died, this blossom of rage occurred that I really needed to get help with.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was also the fact that I was working that sober companion job, and I think that that kind of brought up some, re-triggered some trauma watching the dynamic between this guy and his dad and this guy and his family in general. Uh-huh. And I probably should have taken some time off and just, you know, been proper about the grief and chill out. Yeah. But I didn't leave the job. I just think a lot of things were triggered. I think that I definitely held on to some trauma and some stuff that I didn't even realize. And then when my dad was gone, it was like, it came up like a volcano.
What form did it take?
Is
that when you relapsed? No.
No. This was...
You went through this all sober.
Yeah, man.
I know. Right. Because we were having a problem, me and you, when he died. And then we didn't get to talk about it till after, I think, right?
That's right. And I had to put the dog down. I was down the street. I was mad at you because you didn't call me back. I was putting my... You know how I was with my dogs.
Yeah.
Like, those were my last thread to my emotional beauty.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
When they were gone.
You had a long time, yeah.
Yeah, I just shut down, you know? And I think it really came in the form of just completely shutting down, not being emotionally available to my wife.
You're so lucky you didn't fucking relapse. How'd you not relapse?
I don't know, Mark. I kept going to meetings. I went to therapy. I just kept doing this.
Knowing your history.
Yeah, and I had a lot of money. I was making, you know, you make good effing money doing that job, man. They pay you $1,000 a day, whatever it is. I don't know. Something must have happened. That's the magic of the program. It's grace.
Yeah.
We get carried somehow through something that has nothing to do really with our actions. I really believe that. You could take all the action in the world.
Yeah.
If you have an obsession to get loaded, do crazy sex shit, eat a fucking sheet cake, it's going to happen. Not like a sheet cake and Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah. But did you do EMDR?
I didn't. I really would like to experience that. I have not done that yet. I know. I'll talk to him.
But how did you, like, what did you do to process then? What'd you track it to? Like, you know, you go in, you shut down, you know, the rage, and like, yeah, I can't be pretty with a guy like you, the rage. You're at the verge of wrecking your marriage or the relationship.
It wasn't, you know what, the thing is when I get that shut down, it's just, I want to be alone. So yes, I was at the verge of wrecking it in the form of just bowing out ungracefully and being like, I need to be alone, which has been my thing in every relationship. Yeah. When something re-triggers that kind of trauma,
right,
that mommy did, right, that dad did, right, that kind of shit. So
you had it from both sides. I mean, you're kind of on your own. Both your parents were kind of spun out.
Yeah, totally spun out. And between, you know, between my dad and my mom, I had like 9 different mother and father figures, you know, between their boyfriends, girlfriends, marriages, whatever. So what does that look like? It looks like going to therapy. It looks like not sharing really in meetings. I never took this stuff to meetings. I just didn't feel comfortable with it. Especially familial stuff, dad and mom stuff.
But you started doing the Al-Anon more too, yeah?
That really helped, yeah. And I also just accepted that I'm going to be a tightly wound fucking guy sometimes, man. And there's no way out of it.
But you don't have to be a criminal.
You don't have to be
an emotionally abusive freak.
No, I don't. I got to tell you something, man. You probably don't know it, but you've definitely inspired me over the years, because I remember before you started this, I think you were having some suicidal ideations.
Oh, God, dude, I was going spiraling in the drain, man.
Yeah.
Sitting out there on that porch, that patio, on that deck right there, just writing things down, calling everybody.
Yeah.
Dude, that's not good, man.
Right.
Fuck her.
Right. Of course. And what do? I mean, we get through that in some way, shape, or form.
You do.
Yeah.
It's like you don't, and there's no way to know it.
No.
That you're going to.
No, there is no way to know it. Sometimes it's just walking. Like, I walk a lot.
It's so horrible just to feel that. You can't sleep.
Right.
You know, you're just fucking beating the shit out of yourself. Right. You're full of rage. You can't function socially right.
Yeah.
You know,
before I met my wife, a friend of mine lived in Vietnam. A couple other guys from the program were going every year. They'd go to Angkor Wat. They would do like really cool spiritual stuff, right? Yeah. And I was like, that sounds like a good thing.
Yeah.
Why don't I go to Southeast Asia as a single man? Yeah. Like, and I wasn't thinking that, Mark.
Compulsive,
I promise.
compulsive sex problem, single man.
And I definitely had a spiritual awakening to one of the, like, the grossest fucking bottoms I'd ever hit. In sexual addiction, like, it's so funny when you're in Southeast Asia and you're doing all this crazy sexual behavior, and I just met women everywhere, and it wasn't even like prostitutes. It was hanging out in internet cafes.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go to dinner.
Yeah.
Just go back to the hotel. It was so open and cool and very Buddhist.
Yeah.
Like, you're there, and that's totally cool.
So framing it as a spiritual experience. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
Yeah, you go to Angkor Wat. Yeah, you're sitting with a monk.
Yeah.
Then later on, you're meeting this girl in a cafe.
Yeah.
It's just, it felt so natural there. But when you're coming through customs at LAX, and you're back in America, and you're back in, like, our place.
Yeah.
The guilt and shame was so thick.
Yeah.
And it lasted a while.
Yeah.
And that fixing on sex on that level, like whether it was prostitutes or massage parlors or fuck, going down Figueroa at, you know, after a meeting and picking up a girl in a corner was removed. It was totally removed. Yeah. Now, is that because of the level of shame and guilt that I don't want to re-experience? I think it's a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something that separates me from that, because my last bottom with anything will not remind me not to do that thing again. Do you know what I mean?
I get you, but there is something to like, once you get the space to integrate, you know, the shame and to you know, make an amends or let that shit go a bit, wisdom does kick in. We're middle-aged guys, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And we're sober guys. So, you know, once you find you're fucking compulsive in this other area, at least you know the framework of how it works.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, you're right.
So
maybe it is nipping in the bud before really falling for that trick again.
Yeah, but those things, right, you know, the things with sex and food is that you need them both.
Yeah.
You know, booze and drugs you don't need either.
That's true. That's
so
true.
So you're negotiating with that stuff. And I think that as we get space and as you get older and as you're not fucked up on the other stuff, you're like, that guy a little out of hand.
Right.
That almost went to a bad place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think you're right. Between doing the work, whatever the work looks like, whether it's some therapeutic stuff or just an accountability thing I do with a couple of guys on a thread every day.
Right.
And, you know, just a little more self-care.
And the obsession does get lifted. But the weird thing with any of them, they can get reactivated.
Yeah.
And, you know, with porn or with sex or whatever, you know, it's not the same as going to buy crack or smoking. You know, it's not the same
as not.
Going to get dope or getting fucked up on booze.
You don't have to leave your house.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right? You got to create your own little, you don't have to, you don't need anything, you don't need to put anything into the system.
No.
Other than into your fucking eyeballs.
Right.
Right. And then you just got a little shame portal, a little shame compartment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to go down that road again. I don't want to go back.
Well, I'm glad you're still alive, man. I'm glad you're doing all right.
I am too. And I really appreciate this. Can I give a little shout out? Not a shout out. Can I tell people when the launch party is? It's 1/21/18. At Stories Books Cafe.
January 21st?
2018, yeah.
Definitely. And congrats on the book.
Thank you.
All right, buddy.
Thanks, buddy.
So that's it. That's our little in-between Christmas and New Year's show. Monday's show will be a special collection of moments with my family. Spend New Year's Day with the Marins. On Thursday, we'll have our first new show of 2018 with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Great conversation. So, do I play guitar now? Do I play a little? All right. I'll turn it on. Okay, I'll do a little. Careful out there.